Hello, I'm Bill Wicks. This is number 0298, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0298. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet medical thriller writer Dr. Peter Clement, who has just been nominated for an Arthur Ellis Award for his most recent work, a short story called Therapy.
The whole process of writing is still a bit of a mystery to me, even in writing mysteries. For instance, with Therapy, the material is rather dark, but I thought it was something that would be fascinating in a story, but I had a lot of trouble finding the character, finding the voice. Also, it was material that had to be handled in a very sensitive and very particular way. I worked on it for a couple of years and just couldn't get it right. Then I realized, instead of at the time, I was trying to write a novel, and one day it just suddenly fell away and I realized, no, this is a short story.
Carolyn Bond, author of Parent with Confidence, talks about the free-range parenting movement.
The free-range parent is a parent who allows the child to go out and have some time alone, discover the world, make mistakes, suffer the consequences, have a skinned knee, that kind of thing. It's really taking parenting back to the way that a lot of parents were brought up before this situation that exists now where there's so much fear.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. Book Banter goes back 52 years in time to the Kennedy White House with 2 days in June. So get ready to be a witness to history coming up on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0298 was Bill Wicks, who is a Stuff File program listener in the Montreal area. Thank you very much, Bill, for doing the guest late on this program. A program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? The latest museum to dump knowledge on Italy is the Museo della Merda, a facility dedicated to the study of human and animal feces. The Museo della Merda, which roughly translates to Museum of Poop, although the intended wording is somewhat more profane, describes itself as an agency for change that houses documents and information on excrement in culture, technology, and history. The Poozeum aims to show what a useful and living substance crap really is. Headquartered in the Piacenza province hamlet of Castelbosco, it held a launch event at the Leonardo da Vinci Museum of Science and Technology in Milan. The exhibit tracks the history of excrement and seeks to educate visitors on the ways poo is put to good use around the world. Few phenomena are so rich in material and conceptual complexity as the cultural history of excrement, the museum said. And by the way, they didn't use the word excrement. Just let you know that right now. The museum was founded by Giantonio Locatelli, a farmer who wanted to put the 220,000 pounds of excrement created by his animals each day. That's a lot of crap. Wow. He wanted to put that to good use. Museum tours can be arranged for Saturdays and Sundays between May and August. Wow. If this is a highlight of your vacation itinerary, then you have missed the entire point of Europe, haven't you? Meanwhile, 37-year-old Lucas Hinch of Colorado Springs, Colorado, says even though he got a citation from police, it was worth it. It was glorious, he said. Angels sung on high. He had been fed up for the last several months with his bulky Dell desktop computer, and, well, he had just gotten a new gun, a 9mm pistol. No hothead, Hinch took the computer into an alley behind his home, made sure that there was nothing beyond his computer that could be hurt, and then let loose with 8 rounds. Thus, it was premeditated, oh, definitely, Hinch said. Police tweeted that Hinch had executed the machine. He was cited for discharging a weapon within city limits. The computer, the local newspaper concluded, is not expected to recover. Ah, yes, the 9mm. When Control-Alt-Delete just isn't enough anymore. You know, I don't condone gun violence of any kind, but in this case, I do understand it. Yes, yes, I do. A British man caught stealing coins from a parking meter was banned from using vending machines or any other coin-operated devices until 2020. 38-year-old Russell Stansfield of Dirker, England, was caught stealing from a parking meter in Bury earlier this year, and he admitted in court to committing multiple similar petty thefts on a variety of coin-operated machines. Bury Magistrates Court ruled this week to slap Stansfield with a criminal behavioral order banning him from using coin-operated machines, including parking meters and vending machines, until February 2020. The only exceptions to the order allow Stansfield to use a payphone to call emergencies, or to make emergency calls, rather, or use a Metrolink machine to purchase a ticket, but he must immediately move away from the machine once his ticket has been issued. The order also bans Stansfield from any airports or airport parking lots unless he can prove he is traveling. He was also banned from Trafford Center and its parking lot. It's just weird that if I'm going to be honest, that there are so many things I can't do, Stansfield told reporters after the order was issued. If I'm at the hospital for hours, for example, I can't buy any food from the machines. Stansfield, who apologized for his crimes and said he committed them during a tough time, joked the order could occasionally come in handy. At least I have an excuse not to pay for anything, he says. I think I might be the only person in the country with this bizarre restriction, or even the world. Well, you know, you committed the crimes, and now the punishment, odd as it may be, is that basically every vending machine in England has a restraining order against you. Deal with it. The alternative could easily be that you would be behind bars. Would you prefer that? Huh? Would you? Would you? Anyway, we have time for one more Stuff File News item in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. 39-year-old Liana Barrientos of New York has been married at least 10 times, including 6 times in 1 6-month span. The problem, according to the Bronx District Attorney's Office, is that Liana never got any divorces. Prosecutors have filed felony charges against her, alleging at least 2 counts of filing a false instrument. When a reporter went to her apartment to get a statement, he was told that she had moved into a homeless shelter. Wait a minute. A homeless shelter? I mean, couldn't she stay with her husband? Or her husband? Or her husband? Or her husband? Or you get the picture. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Dr. Peter Clement is one of those very popular hybrids. He's a physician who is also the best-selling author of medical thrillers. He wrote the Earl Garnett medical thriller series Lethal Practice, Death Rounds, and The Procedure, just to name a few. He's also written the Richard Steele novels Mutant and its sequel Critical Condition. His most recent work is a short story called Therapy, which has just been nominated for an Arthur Ellis Award. And Peter joins us on the line right now from Ottawa. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. And first of all, congratulations on the nomination. I understand the awards will be given out in late May?
That's right. Yes.
So you've written, as I mentioned, this new short story called Therapy. And first of all, you've written a couple of, shall we say, series, thriller series. How do you go about deciding when you need to write a new protagonist as opposed to continuing with whatever one you start off with?
The whole process of writing is still a bit of a mystery to me, even in writing mysteries. For instance, with Therapy, the material is rather dark, but I thought it was something that would be fascinating in a story, and I very much wanted to deal with it. But I had a lot of trouble finding the character, finding the voice. My existing characters that I'd written about before just didn't work. Also, it was material that had to be handled in a very sensitive and very particular way. I had quite a number of not really false starts, because I think in writing, you know, there's it seems like a lot of trial and error, but often in the struggle to get it right, and suddenly it sort of takes you to unexpected areas at work. But I worked on it for a couple of years and just couldn't get it right. And then I realized, instead of, at the time, I was trying to write a novel of this subject matter. And one day it just suddenly fell away, and I realized, no, this is a short story. The basic parts were there, and once I did that, then I wrote it in 5 weeks.
Besides the fact that you decided it was going to be a short story, you said earlier it didn't work with any of your other characters. Was that the initial intent, to make it a story that dealt with one of your regular characters, and it just didn't work, or was that just off the table completely?
It was just, as I said, I wanted to deal with the areas that therapy does cover, and it had to do with damage to a young protagonist. And when I, you know, tried to figure out, okay, who would this person be, who would he become, it just didn't fit the other characters that I had written about before. So this time it needed me to create someone entirely new. And it was initially a struggle, and then suddenly it all came together after kind of letting it brew in my brain for a couple of years, and then it worked.
What is the story of Therapy about?
It's about an unpardonable crime, and which has done very deep damage to the protagonist. And it is about then the and how that kind of damage is ubiquitous, and it affects not just the individual who is the protagonist, but it's transgenerational, in that it seems to keep, it has affected that person's parents, that person's partners, even that person's offspring. And in the midst of all that is, it's about a journey about healing and about an attempt at redemption, how that works out. I invite your listeners to, you know, perhaps read it. It's, as we said, a short story. I hope they can, you know, find it meaningful and satisfying.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you have several characters that you are now known for. I mentioned the Earl Garnett series. I also talked about Richard Steele. And your eighth book introduced a new character, The Darkness Drops. You introduced Dr. Terry Ryder. So I'm just curious to know what it's like for you, especially at this point in your career when you have several books under your belt, to create, both with The Darkness Drops and now with Therapy, a new character.
I find it very releasing, actually. It lets me go into new territory. The Darkness Drops was modeled after an individual I actually met, who was an advisor to the White House and Homeland Security in the States on bioterror preparedness. And I met with him and his co-workers, and I just found them fascinating. These are the people that literally sit down and think up the scenarios that bad people in the world might do in the realm of bio weapons, and then work out remedies or counter moves that might neutralize those sort of attempts. The thing that struck me when I met them, I said, "Well, you do exactly what a writer does. It's come up with villains and plots, and then try and address them and try and save the day." These people in particular go into situations that scare the hell out of me. also have to live with these possibilities and probabilities, and yet also try to have ordinary lives, presumably with spouses and children, and not let their nightmares kind of intrude on activities of everyday living.
Well, I was about to ask you about some of your nightmares. The reason why is, I mean, you write these medical thrillers, and you are a practicing physician, so you know of what you speak, you research what you do. When you hear and read what's happening in the news on any given day, what kinds of things scare you medically?
Oh, wow. I mean, well, for instance, the Darkness Drops, I completed that in about 2010 when we first published it. And a lot of it was conjecture about how, you know, what would happen were there a bioweapon that had unleashed something entirely unknown, and how would that affect healthcare systems? How would that, you know, how would one respond to that? And since that time, you know, we've had the, you know, how easily healthcare can be derailed or overwhelmed. You know, we've had the issues with Ebola, and how, you know, frightening and quickly and potentially out of control that could become. We've had also in that book are some ideas behind how the country of Russia and the country of China, you know, may be involved in rather nefarious activities with bioweapons and the possible way that they might be used. That was hypothetical at the time, and now we're looking at China acting out, and who knows what Putin's up to. So just in the matter of 5 years, that book has become even more relevant now than it was when I first released it. And so it's when reality starts taking on the books, that's what scares me.
Well, what and another, going again with the idea of what scares you most, as I'm sure you're aware, there are places around the world, the CDC comes to mind, where there are diseases that are kept in storage. What scares you more, somebody doing something nefarious or an accident taking place?
Accidents. I just think unintended consequences that, I mean, just some of the other things that have come through is this, you know, debate about putting on the internet how to genetically modify some of these agents, and for the name of science and unrestricted research. I just think that's nuts, you know, that this stuff should be, like any other weapon, be certainly available to people with expertise and who are vetted and who have been, you know, granted in the proper equipment and the proper centers. But just freedom of information on these issues, I just think it, and, it, you know, it's not just that I think it, there have been lapses in various level four labs where organisms have escaped. And that's where I think the big trouble will come. Probably not intentional supervillains, but just hubris and arrogance and questionable policy about who's doing what with these kind of this kind of work, and then a whoops moment, and we're all in big trouble.
We have just about a minute, and I started off by talking about the fact that your latest short story, Therapy, has been nominated for an Arthur Ellis Award. What does that mean to you to be nominated for this award?
Well, it was a wonderful surprise. I did not expect it, and I think it just validates, you know, what a writer is doing. It's certainly a lonely profession when you finally sit down after the research and everything and have to do the creation. And particularly this story that, you know, brewed in my head for quite a long time before I got it out satisfactorily on paper. So to be recognized like this is quite wonderful.
The short story is Therapy, and the Arthur Ellis Awards take place in late May on the 28th. Congratulations on the nomination and good luck on the 28th. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is peterclementbooks.com, correct?
That's right. And Therapy is right at the top of the list there. They can find out where to get it for whatever e-device they've got, and all the links are there, and I hope they visit.
Thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Peter Clement, author of the short story Therapy, nominated for an Arthur Ellis Award. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0298, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca where you can order his book directly. Plus, you'll find links to Peter's website.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about free-range parenting, plus Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter, and we do, of course, have an idiot of the day coming your way here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But right now, I got a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you. And this collection of stories, before we get to our next guest, which, by the way, kind of leads up to our next guest in a way, but this next collection of stories deal with something that, if you listen to this program enough, you know is something that really annoys me a lot, and that's zero-tolerance policies that will rather break than bend a little, especially when it comes to kids, because they're just asinine stories, and they come in all shapes and sizes, all flavors and varieties, and the three that we have here for you actually cover a spectrum. So here we go. The first one, a Colorado mother said her daughter's preschool teacher barred her from eating the Oreo cookies packed in her lunch because they were not nutritious. Lisa Pearson, whose four-year-old daughter, Natalie, attends the private school, the Children's Academy in Aurora, as an Aurora Public School student under the state's preschool option plan, said Natalie returned home from school Friday and told her that she was not allowed to eat her Oreo cookies at lunch. Pearson said Natalie still had the cookies, which had been packed along with a ham and cheese sandwich and a stick of string cheese, along with a note from her teacher. The note read, "Dear parents, it is very important that all students have a nutritious lunch. This is a public school setting, and all children are required to have a fruit, a vegetable, and a healthy snack from home, along with milk. If they have potatoes, the child will also need bread to go along with it. Lunchables, chips, fruit snacks, and peanut butter are not considered to be a healthy snack. This is a very important part of our program, and we need everyone's participation." "I don't agree with it at all," Pearson told the media. "They don't provide lunch for my daughter. I provide lunch," Pearson said. "It's between me and the doctor in terms of what's healthy for her. An Aurora Public Schools spokeswoman said Natalie was offered a healthy alternative to the cookies. The director of the Children's Academy said the note should not have been sent out and is being investigated. She said that schools do not have any policies regarding telling students what they can or cannot eat at lunchtime. So there. Which once again just goes to show that somewhere in this school is a deranged, power-hungry food Nazi. And if you're trying to figure out which person it is, well, look for the one with kale wedged between their teeth. Story number two in the same vein of zero tolerance. 11-year-old Brianna Cooper was so upset at witnessing a teacher berate another student at Samuel Gaines Academy in Fort Pierce, Florida, that she set her phone to record the tirade. "Don't let size fool you. I will drop you," the unnamed science teacher told the other student. "You don't know me. That's all I'm saying. So don't give me no look." There's a double negative there. Should a teacher be using a double negative? Anyway, Brianna considered it bullying and says she had heard the teacher do it before. She made the recording because, quote, "Do you think that they would actually believe a student over a teacher?" When she turned the recording over to school authorities, Principal Tracy Wilkie took strong, decisive action. She accused Brianna of making an illegal recording. "I thought I did the right thing," the girl said, "but I guess I just got suspended." Indeed so, for 5 days. But police said that such a recording is not illegal when there's no expectation of privacy, and Brianna's mother said the message the school officials are sending is, "If you think something is wrong, don't try to do anything about it." The day after the story hit the media, yes, it hit the media, because it always does, doesn't it? The school announced that it took swift, appropriate action by firing the teacher for her unprofessional behavior. Sadly, the real message school officials are sending, if you expect them to do the right thing, you have to make your story available to the media. Also, if they took what they called swift and appropriate action, then perhaps they should also fire the pinhead principal, Tracy Wilkie, for her knee-jerk punishment towards Brianna. Just a thought. I'm also guessing there will be lawsuits all the way around here. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and this one is also in a similar vein, and right from our own backyard here in Quebec. 8-year-old Sarah Auger is a rarity among kids these days. Rather than play with a smartphone or handheld game console, the girl from Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu here in Quebec chose to spend her 20-minute bus ride to and from school each day to read real paper books. Not e-readers, although they're fine. Not e-readers, but dead tree readers. You know, she went old school. Literally old school. Well, she did, at least, read on the bus these books until the bus driver told her to stop because it might not be safe. Now, listen to this. How so, you ask? Well, other students might stand up to get a better look at what she's reading because, you know, to children today, apparently a book is something you only see in a museum and it's kind of odd. Or she may poke herself in the eye with the corner of the book. Yeah, because how many children over the years of reading have done that? How many one-eyed kids have poked their eyes out with a book? Does she have any pencils or pens in her backpack, by the way? Anyway, what did he go on to say? "I find it stupid and useless." That's what the father of Sarah said. The father is Daniel Abel, who complained to the school board about the rule. But the school board said bus safety is a purview of the transportation company and refused to intervene. Bosses at the Autobus Richelieu are backing the driver. "Our only goal is to make sure students are safe," said spokeswoman Nancy Menard, who said the rule actually came to them from the school board and complaints about the rule are unfair. "We have to put it into context that there are 50 students on the bus." Yes, 50 students. And you wouldn't want them all wielding books, would you? Those dangerous projectiles that could pull out an eye at any moment. Yeah. because, you know, it would be chaos if more than one kid ended up actually being smarter and well-read. Yeah, chaos. Absolute chaos. Anyway, let's go to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Long before the Maryland couples clash with authorities over their young children's walk home alone from a park, parents have debated the issue. How much supervision do children need? And when are they truly at risk? Parenting expert Carolyn Bond is here to talk about that issue. She's the author of Parent with Confidence, Power Tools for Bringing Up Great Kids. And she joins us on the line right now from Ontario. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So I guess it's a fine line between over-parenting, or the I guess the line between free-range parenting and helicopter parenting, correct?
Well, they're two kind of opposite concepts of parenting. The helicopter parent is a parent who hovers over her or his child, helping with homework, always there, supervising everything that the child does, not letting the child walk to school alone, always having to be there to make sure the child is safe, in quotation marks, safe. Whereas it appears the free-range parent is a parent who allows the child to go out and have some time alone, discover the world, make mistakes, suffer the consequences, have a skinned knee, that kind of thing. It's really taking parenting back to the way that a lot of parents were brought up before this situation that exists now where there's so much fear.
Have you followed the story of that couple in Maryland with their two children who were walking alone and were picked up by the police because they were walking alone?
Yes, I have followed it. And interestingly enough, my son lives in Silver Spring. And before they were picked up, he told me that if an 8-year-old child were seen on the street walking alone, that child would be picked up by the police. Someone would call the police. And it's a total case of overreaction, and it's all about fear. And it's interesting, Peter, because I was talking with an American, Floridian pediatrician, and he told me that the biggest challenge in parenting today is the media. And what he meant by that was that there's so much in the news about what goes wrong everywhere, and it's so prevalent, and everybody is you know, can get that news anywhere in the world, about any spot in the world, that it's made people be afraid in their own neighborhood when there isn't really anything to be afraid of.
I'm glad you brought up that point of the media, because I am in the media, and I also feel that we are guilty of that. And I'll take it one step further. The police in Maryland have now scared these two kids literally to death. Because they've told them what can go wrong. They've picked them up like they're common criminals, and they've scared these two children. But now I feel the parents are going to have a problem, because they've received so much media attention that it is actually, I think, to a certain degree, put their children in danger.
Well, yes, there is that likelihood. You're right. But it's so interesting, because all the statistics show that there's far less chance of anything happening to kids out there than there has been for years. And usually what happens to kids, if they're abducted or if there's a sexual crime, it's often someone in the family or a family friend. It's not a stranger. And what's happening is that these kids are growing up without a chance to stretch themselves, make their own decisions, and think independently. How are they going to do that when they're adults, if they're not given a chance to try it and suffer the consequences of their own mistakes and pick up and learn from them?
So obviously you believe that children should have more opportunities to experience the world a little bit rather than have the helicopter parent. But having said that, were there things you did as a child that you wouldn't let your own children do?
Probably. I mean, most people would say yes. You if you're allowed out, and obviously you're going to explore. And I mean, I remember digging a cave with a couple of friends, and it probably wasn't safe at all. But I mean, this is what happens. There are dangers, but unless parents are going to be standing by every single second, the risks are there, but the risks have to be taken. How many times do you hear about a kid having a tunnel fall in on them and suffocating to death? I don't think that's a very prevalent thing.
One of the other people I had an opportunity to talk to several years ago was Lenore Scanese. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she writes a blog about free-range kids, and she had sent her child at the age of 9, which is something I really understood completely. She took her son downtown in New York City. She had taken him several times downtown to New York City, and this was the day that was going to be his test. She was going to take him downtown, leave him there, and let him come home on the subway by himself.
Yes, I recall that case, yes. And she has a big blog and has had a lot of publicity over that, that's for sure. Now, you see, I've got a Facebook page where there's been thorough discussion of this situation. And there are parents out there who are totally terrified of letting their children out of their sight. And it's not warranted. What I think is that people need to let their children have more freedom within a structure of safety, so that you would allow the child to go out into a perimeter, say set a perimeter as far as the child, so that the child can only go so far, and to be checked on once in a while. I mean, a lot of people think that what she did with the subway episode was kind of a little over the top. But on the other hand, she knew her kid, and she had prepared him, and really, as I said before, the likelihood of some stranger abducting him is really very, very slim.
And you brought up that very first point. She knew her kid, and I sometimes people tend to forget that parents know their children best.
That's right, and there are a lot of kids who are at 9 a lot more mature than some young adults. And when you think back many, many years ago to our grandfather's and great-grandfather's time, there were kids of 11 years old managing farms at the time. I mean, these kids know a lot more than we give them credit for. And what I think parents need to do is to stand back and say, What can I do for my child that he cannot do for himself? And then step in and offer help. But not take over, do their scout projects, do their science projects, help them with the homework, you know, be on the line to the school all the time. Kids need to have some freedom. They need to be able to grow up.
Your book, the title is Parent with Confidence, and I'm sure for some parents, especially first-time parents, that's a bit of an oxymoron, because parents sometimes feel they don't know anything. So how do you get the confidence to be a parent, especially if you're a first-time one?
Well, this book that I've written has just jumped out of my head because of my experience using the approach that I am talking about in the book. And what it is, it's giving parents the chance to have a system to follow, steps to follow that are tried and true, that have been used all over the world for over 50 years. And it works. And if you start from the premise of respecting your child as a person, mutual respect happens, and you go along a path that's very easy to follow. And in my book, what I've done is I've outlined the basic approach in the first 5 chapters, and then I've got another 20 chapters on different problems, everyday problems that parents can solve, such as fighting between the kids and picky eating and temper tantrums, sleeping problems, that kind of thing. And using the approach, you can just... And it's just amazing how this works. And then you develop confidence by seeing how how successful you've been in handling these problems.
And people can find out more information by going to your website. You have a couple of them, I understand. HowToBringUpGreatKids.com and
yes.
ParentWithConfidence.com. What will people find when they go to the websites?
Well, if they go to ParentWithConfidence.com, they will be led to my book page on my other website. And they just click on a button there, and it takes you, well, first of all, there's an information about the book. And then it takes you to where they can order the book.
Carolyn, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's always a very interesting topic to discuss parenting, especially as it changes with time. And as you said earlier, we spend a lot of time in the media dwelling on it.
Well, that's true, because people don't know what to do, Peter. They don't know what to do. They're going on the internet. They're searching for answers to this and to that, but there's nothing that's kind of a unified approach, a simple unified approach like I have in my book. And my book also, I should just mention, is small, it's slim, it's concise, it's easy to find the answers to problems.
Carolyn, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much for asking me.
Carolyn Bond, author of Parent with Confidence, Power Tools for Bringing Up Great Kids. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0298, and you'll find links to Carolyn's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. If there's one lawsuit nearly everyone has heard about, it'd have to be the one against McDonald's over spilled coffee. But that's not the most frivolous case against McDonald's. No, that distinction would probably go to a lawsuit involving a spilled milkshake. Yes, several years ago, a man pulled up at their drive-thru window and bought a milkshake and fries. He put the drink between his legs and drove away. As he reached for some fries, he squeezed the milkshake with his legs and it spilled on him. Distracted, he hit another car and caused minor damage. Then, the driver who was hit sued McDonald's for failing to warn the customer about drinking a milkshake while driving. Let's be fair, this lawsuit is obviously ridiculous, and it was eventually thrown out by the New Jersey Supreme Court. But when the restaurant asked to be reimbursed for the thousands of dollars it spent on legal fees, the court said no. And that is just one reason why there are so many lawsuits clogging America's courts these days. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And coming to you somewhere from the grassy knoll is Stuart Nauman. Hello, Stu.
Like I say, Von Meter for some reason. Yeah, you remember Von Meter.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, he was, how can I say, that time on the grassy knoll, well, that time in Dallas in November 63, his career just was gone after that.
Yeah, Von Meter had a great comedy album, and then it was over.
Yeah. Thanks to those days in Dallas. But on this edition of Book Banter, we're not talking about Von Meter, but we're talking about the man he made a career out of for a very short period, John F. Kennedy, 35th President of the United States. And although he was President of the United States for only 1,000 days, John F. Kennedy's brief time in the White House has been marked by so many tumultuous events, such as the Bay of Pigs invasion, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the space race, civil rights movement, the early rumblings of the Vietnam War, and, of course, the Cold War. Now, however, journalist and author Andrew Cohen, who is from Montreal, believes that 2 days in the final year of Kennedy's presidency, in particular June 10th and 11th of 1963, did more to solidify his historical legacy, and he effectively explains why those 2 days made such a difference in his excellent book, 2 Days in June. Now, Cohen argues that those 2 days in June of 1963 stood out for Kennedy because of two things. a speech that he delivered at American University, which was labeled the peace speech, on the morning of the 10th, which led to the subsequent signing of the nuclear test ban treaty later that year.
I actually saw that speech not that long ago, and it's a pretty powerful speech.
It is.
Yep.
And on a very hot day, just outside of Washington, D.C., wearing those black robes, and people were actually passing out while he was delivering the speech because of the heat.
Yeah.
Not because it was boring, believe me. Yes, it was a powerful speech. And then there was a speech he delivered on TV to the American public the following day, calling for a Civil Rights Act after a tense standoff when Alabama Governor George Wallace tried to bodily block the enrollment of two black students at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah, George was a bundle of fun, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. Yeah, Southern charm. He just dripped out of his pores, let me tell you.
Yeah, something was dripping out of his pores, that's for sure.
Yeah, and that was also a very hot day. It was like 97 degrees, and he was wearing a charcoal gray suit. And yeah, two very hot days in more ways than one.
Wow, when did you turn into Mr. Blackwell all of a sudden?
Well, I couldn't see myself, wearing a charcoal gray suit in, deep south in June, and it's 97 degrees plus humidity. You know what I mean?
That's true.
Yes. The book gives the reader an intimate fly-on-the-wall account of how Kennedy spent these crucial 2 days throughout the morning, afternoon, and evening, and no details spared in order to give the reader a complete picture of how a president of the United States utilized practically every minute of those days towards making history. And also what I like about it is the reader also gets an intimate look at the human side of the Kennedy presidency. We discover that no matter how busy his schedule was, he always found time for a midday swim in a heated White House pool to help with his chronic back pain, followed by a nap. And
yeah,
Kennedy enjoyed hearing the latest political gossip from the source. And this was exemplified during those 2 days with his fascination with the Profumo scandal. If you know, that was the scandal in Britain,
right,
when a top government official allegedly was having an affair with a hooker who was allegedly having an affair with a Soviet spy. And led to the collapse of Harold Macmillan's government as well.
Well, there is also a lot of other things he managed to find time to squeeze into the course of his days.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm sure, a whole other book.
Yes, but we're just talking about these 2 days only.
Yes.
And at a luncheon he attended at the home of a Washington newspaper columnist, his name was Joseph Alsop, he relentlessly questioned one of the guests, who was the wife of a visiting British MP Hugh Fraser. It was Antonia Fraser, who became a best-selling author in her own right by the end of the 60s, until he got all the information he wanted to know about the growing scandal in London dealing with Profumo. And Cohen chronicles practically every movement Kennedy made throughout those significant 2 days, which is a testament to how every minute of the U.S.'s chief executive is constantly filled from a stream of Oval Office appointments and meetings to the never-ending phone calls he received and returned. Now, 2 days in June, I find that the fascinating behind-the-scenes look at how two major issues that defined the presidency of John F. Kennedy happened with such great impact in such a short period of time, and how those 2 days in the sweltering late spring of 1963 forever transformed John F. Kennedy from a good president to a great president.
Although, it's interesting you say that because, I don't disagree with that statement at all, but there are so many people who, once you take political correctness out of the equation, because, the man was assassinated, would say that he wasn't that great of a president and he didn't have a lot of time to prove that he was either mediocre or not.
Well, that's you may have a point there, but the things that he did do in the short term. I mean, averting a Cuban missile, the Cuban Missile Crisis, averting total war as a result, just leading the way towards a Civil Rights Act, which was signed, and made into law when Johnson was president, and yes, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Those are pretty impressive, accomplishments. Just think what could have happened if he, wasn't assassinated. I mean, he was thinking about withdrawing troops from Vietnam as early as 1964, so, there's a lot of what might have been, but, there's never a shortage of material to write about for John F. Kennedy. There have been a lot of books, and I think there will continue to be more books that will zero in on certain aspects of his life and presidency.
Hmm. And the book, again, is?
It's called 2 Days in June by Andrew Cohen. He's a Montrealer. And it's published by Signal, McClellan & Stewart, and it's $34.
And dare I ask, because you could fill an entire library, JFK library in itself, but you could fill an entire library with books about JFK. So can you pick one or two others that you'd like to recommend in addition to this one?
Yeah, and I've seen a person who does have a very thorough JFK library. Two that I could think of is, first of all, 1,000 Days by Arthur Schlesinger, published in 1965. It was a huge bestseller. I think it was probably the first book to give a thorough history of the Kennedy administration, and also from one of his top insiders. And also, The Day Kennedy Was Shot by Jim Bishop, which was a bestseller in 1967, which gives a minute-by-minute account of November 22nd, 1963. Fascinating book.
Excellent stuff. And again, this week's book is?
2 Days in June by Andrew Cohen, published by Signal, McClellan, and Stewart, and it's $34.
And when you're not hanging out in the book depository, where can we find you?
Which I was. I was there in the bookshop of the book depository. You can find me in the Montreal Times every week, not the Dallas Morning News, in print, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome there, Mr. Holder.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about on the home stretch for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but we have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now. And you know, Florida is a Stuff File news goldmine, and here we have a couple of items that we could simply title inexplicable. Number one, 21-year-old Mohamed Almari was arrested on multiple charges in Tampa on April 12th after illegally entering a neighbor's apartment in a high-rise and forcing the owner onto the balcony. For reasons undisclosed in the police report, Almari then allegedly microwaved the man's wallet in his oven. I don't know why. And 35-year-old Joseph Williams, and with several pending warrants out for his arrest, by the way, was arrested on April 5th in Fort Pierce, Florida, after entering the emergency room at Lawnwood Regional Medical Center and Heart Institute, demanding an enema and refusing to leave until he got one. Yes, Florida, where there's never a dull moment. And I think I have another Florida story to share with you here. A man and a woman have been arrested in Central Florida after police say they stole more than $300 worth of meat from a grocery store. Deputies reported that 48-year-old Doris Rao and 54-year-old Kenneth Edwards drove 26 miles to a Winn-Dixie store in DeLand, where a store manager saw Rao stuffing meat products and other items into her pants. Deputies say the manager stopped Rao and she hit the manager in the neck, dropping pork ribs, 2 packs of detergent, and 3 water filters. Rao fled the store and got into Edwards' truck. Deputies apprehended them at a traffic stop. Both were charged with grand theft and robbery. Deputies found ribeye steaks, ground beef, bacon, pork ribs, and a gallon of bleach in the car, valued at $361. I don't think I want that meat back. Thank you very much. Well, traffic came to a stop in Tulsa, Oklahoma, after police chased and tased a naked man running along the highway. Police arrested and charged James Jackson with indecent exposure, obstructing justice, and burglary. Drivers slowed and pulled over when they saw the 24-year-old Jackson walking naked down the LL Tisdale Parkway. At least a couple of passengers recorded the incident with their cell phones. And by the way, for those folks who pulled over with their cell phones who might have been driving and they were taking videos, tickets for all of you. Now, one video shows Jackson slamming his fist on a car as it passes by. He appears to try to open the driver's side door of a truck that stopped to avoid hitting him. Jackson continued to walk down the highway and starts to sing before a police officer arrives and attempts to take him into custody. Jackson ignored numerous commands to stop and get on the ground by Tulsa police officers. That's when an officer unsuccessfully tried to tase him. They used the taser to subdue Jackson, but in the video, Jackson is seen removing the wires from his body and running away again. A second officer shows up and also uses his taser. The two officers eventually get him on the ground and carry him away. Jackson might have been having a mental episode or was just under the influence of drugs, according to police. You figure? Yeah. Or maybe he just liked being naked. Who knows? Anyway. As odd as that is not the story that is the idiot of the day. But this, boys and girls, this is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the idiot of the day.
Nico Jenkins, convicted of murder on a 2013 spree and trying to avoid a scheduled sentencing hearing, recently self-mutilated for the second time, which is what he told a judge in Omaha, Nebraska, that was evidence of his mental disorder that should render him ineligible for death row. Now, Jenkins told the judge that a serpent god had ordered him to carve the number of the beast into his forehead, but apparently, because Jackson was looking into a mirror as he carved it, his forehead display more resembled an upside-down 999 or a lowercase DDD than it did 666. You see, he's trying to claim that he's crazy, when in reality, he's just a dumbass. Because why would someone think that improperly carving the devil's numbers into his forehead was grounds for making him ineligible for the death penalty due to a mental disorder, when you indeed had enough common sense to claim to the judge that the carving would be a mental disorder, but you're not smart enough to know that looking in a mirror would be a reverse image? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0298. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0298. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.